Alta. Protests did not slow down Sunday in Myanmar, a day after security forces shot dead two people at a demonstration in the country's second biggest city. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Another large protest took place in Mandalay near a dockyard where the two protesters were killed by police a day earlier. Many of the protesters, like those who were killed, are workers from the railway or truckers and civil servants who've been taking part in a civil disobedience campaign against the junta. A funeral was also held for a young woman who was killed by police in the capital Naypyidaw on February the 9th, 2 days before her 20th birthday. Her death was the first confirmed death amongst thousands of protesters who've rallied against the February 1st coup that toppled the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. When her body was released, a long motorized procession began a drive to the cemetery. In Yangon, Myanmar's biggest city, about 1,000 demonstrators honored the woman under an elevated roadway. I'm Karen Chamas.
Niger voted on Sunday in the second round of a presidential election that is expected to usher in the first democratic transition of power since a West African nation gained independence. Ruling party candidate Mohamed Bazoum is seen by many as the favorite after leading in the first round on December 27th with 39.3% of the vote. He is up against former President Mahamat Ousmane, who scored 17%. Bazoum is backed by the candidates who came third and fourth in the first round. Crowds of voters in Niamey queued in dusty school courtyards, some wearing masks to protect against COVID-19. Bazoum has vowed to make security a focal point as the country battles surprise insurgencies. This is VOA News. A United Airlines flight landed safely at Denver International Airport on Saturday after suffering a right engine failure. That's according to the Federal Aviation Administration. Dramatic images show debris from the plane scattered on the ground of the U.S. city's suburbs. The airline said the Boeing 777-200 plane was heading to Honolulu, Hawaii, when it suffered engine failure soon after takeoff. In an interview, Rob Ball told KMGH he saw the plane fly overhead.
I heard this loud rumble, and I thought it was a military aircraft because it was really, really loud. It came right over the house, and I watched it, and you could see that the right engine was on fire.
There were 231 passengers and 10 crew members on board, and no reports of injuries either on the plane or on the ground. Iran believes U.S. sanctions will soon be lifted despite continuing diplomatic wrangling over reviving the nuclear deal. A government spokesman made the statement on Saturday, signaling Tehran's desire to end the impasse while not offering a new position. Iran and the United States have been at odds over who should take the first step to revive the 2015 accord. Iran insists that the United States must first lift former President Donald Trump's sanctions, while Washington says Tehran must first return to compliance with the deal. Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny lost his appeal on Saturday against what he said was a politically motivated decision to jail him for nearly 3 years. He was also found guilty of slander and fined in a separate case. The double legal defeat had been anticipated by his supporters, who believe the Kremlin sees the 44-year-old opposition politician as a threat, a notion the Kremlin laughs off. It paves the way for Navalny to be moved from a Moscow jail to a prison camp outside the capital. Warmer temperatures are spreading across the southern United States, bringing some relief to a region weary of winter. The region faces a challenging cleanup and expensive repairs from days of extreme cold and widespread power outages. In the hard-hit state of Texas, where millions were warned to boil tap water before drinking it, the warm-up on Saturday was expected to last for several days. President Joe Biden has declared a major disaster in Texas, directing federal agencies to help in the recovery. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues. President Biden makes big promises at his first town hall, billions in economic aid, millions of new jobs, and vaccines for all by the summer. The death toll in Texas is climbing as millions continue to suffer from the brutal cold without any heat or power. And the GOP at war with itself as former President Trump goes after top Republican lawmaker and former ally Mitch McConnell. Plus, the Biden administration promising to recalibrate ties with Saudi Arabia and considers its next steps in Afghanistan. Jonathan, Ashraf, good to talk to you both. Let's start with Biden's town hall this week with CNN. Biden on a stage in Wisconsin, getting questions from the crowd, a format that usually works for him. And he made a lot of promises there. A massive COVID relief bill to pass within a few weeks, creating 7 million jobs, and vaccines for anyone who wants it by July, plus schools reopening by his first 100 days. We'll get to the school issue in a moment because I want to go in depth there. But let's start with the other items on the list. Jonathan, given what we've been seeing so far, the vaccine rollout under this administration, how likely is it that that July deadline will actually happen?
Experts tend to think that he will make that deadline. And as a matter of fact, that he's setting sort of a low bar so that he can exceed it. So I think that given the production of vaccines right now, that it's very likely that he'll make it. You mentioned earlier the winter storms. That has complicated things right now because it is complicating the distribution of vaccines to many, many states because planes are grounded because of the storm, roads are bad. There might be some delay there, but I'm pretty confident that he's going to make it.
On the issue of vaccines, Biden did get some pushback for saying that there were no vaccines before he came into the office during this town hall. He himself did get a shot before he came into office, so obviously that isn't true. His supporters say he just misspoke since he has given the Trump administration credit in the past. But moving on from that, he did put a lot of self-imposed deadlines on himself at this town hall. People generally crave concrete goals, but does it also, Ashraf, put this administration in a box? And not too long ago, Dr. Fauci said we'd have widely available vaccines by April. Now that's being pushed back to July. So deadlines can be tricky.
Definitely deadlines can be tricky, and seasoned public officials like President Biden, it's wired into their DNA not to put a hard deadline that you can then blow and have people point to you and say, hey, what about this? But as Jonathan said, I think he's working within some very comfortable margins here. He's very deliberately setting reasonably low expectations. As you said, his deadline is July. Dr. Fauci, as of a month ago, was saying, yeah, May seems realistic, maybe early June for everybody. So it is a realistic deadline that he's setting, which is why I think it's not much of a branch that he was climbing out on, which is why I think he was willing to do that publicly.
That's not a bad strategy. Keep the expectations really low, and then you can rise to those low expectations. He's had this sort of honeymoon phase with progressives. But during this town hall, Jonathan, Biden did push back on some of the important agenda items for progressives, like defunding the police and canceling school debt. So how do you see the relationship with that wing of the party going from here?
Well, I think progressives are going to be disappointed, particularly on the school debt. What Biden said was he would be willing to discuss perhaps forgiving $10,000 worth of student debt, but he felt that $50,000, which is what the progressives are demanding, is simply too much. And there's going to be tension. They will continue pressing for it. They haven't given up. And I believe that he will continue to refuse to give in to them.
Both sides sort of came together to beat Donald Trump. Now that that's happened, there are going to be these divisions that keep coming up. I want to talk about schools reopening. It was also brought up at the town hall. Ashraf, it's an issue that really is important to a lot of Americans, especially working mothers, some who have had to give up their own jobs because schools are closed. Can you help us understand what seems to be conflicting messages coming from Biden and his administration on this?
Well, I think a lot of the confusion on the messaging comes from the very complex and spread out nature of authority when it comes to schools in America. It's not really something that he can order. This comes down to regional, local school boards and comes down to charter schools. There's so much autonomy that many of these local systems have that really his opening schools within 100 days, that might be the most sort of dangerous or potential for failure, because that's really not something he can do much about other than lobbying from his very powerful lobbying position in the White House. But you can't really make these school districts do much from Washington. It's a deliberate system that's set up so that the autonomy is on the grassroots level. Here in Washington, D.C., where I live, some public schools are open depending on where they're at with the teachers' union. The private schools, the charter schools are on a different schedule, and very few people can make them do anything.
It's such a good point. This administration, any administration, really doesn't have that kind of control over public schools. It's really a local issue. But Biden did run on that promise to reopen schools in the first 100 days. So he's got to own that issue because he ran on it. And as you mentioned, he does have this massive platform. A lot of criticism here is that the Biden administration is not really following the science. And the CDC just put out this new roadmap to reopen schools. But according to this roadmap, it'll make it really difficult for most schools in the country to reopen. And you have health experts, scientists coming out and saying it is possible to reopen schools relatively safely if you do put mitigation measures in place. It's not 100%, but the flip side we're being told is that it's much worse for kids not to reopen. And as you mentioned, a lot of this has to do with teachers' unions pushing back, Democratic-led teachers' unions. So Jonathan, as Ashraf sort of pointed out, Biden cannot force schools to reopen, but he does have this massive platform to pressure schools and to pressure teachers' union, would you say?
Yes, that's right. And there's a further complication here. There doesn't seem to be, at least until now, a unified message coming out of the White House. So, for example, the White House spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, said in explaining President Biden's promise that after 100 days, a majority of the schools, and she made very clear that she meant 51%, in other words, the minimal majority, would be open for one day a week. And that seemed a bit of a cop-out to a lot of people. Biden then came back during the town hall and clarified and said that he wants to get it to be 5 days a week, but only kindergarten through eighth grade and not secondary schools above those grades. And getting to the issue with the unions want all teachers to be vaccinated before the schools open. Dr. Fauci has said that's not really necessary. So there's a conflict there, or at least a mixed message coming out of the White House on that issue.
And it's not only the White House folks there that seem to have differing ideas of what's possible. Even amongst Democrats, there's a division. For instance, in the city of San Francisco, a very blue city, the mayor there, a Democrat, is suing the school board in that city over reopening. Local officials say they want teachers to be safe. But again, as Jonathan pointed out, the science seems to follow that there is a relatively safe way to open schools, even without fully vaccinating teachers. And Ashraf, just one last question on this. Given that there's this split amongst Democrats, conflicting messages coming from the White House, and a lot of angry parents who want schools to reopen, is this a winning issue for Republicans when we're talking about the 2022 midterm elections? Or by that point, with schools likely to be reopened, will voters have forgotten?
I think 2022 is far enough off that this won't be an issue in those elections. For now, if you're a disgruntled Republican, it's just fun to watch the Democrats sort of like step on each other over this issue. So it's more just fun to watch that it is a relevant political issue that I think will affect an upcoming election.
Okay, let's pause here. When we get back, as you say, Democrats might be split on some issues, but Republicans aren't exactly getting along right now either. Look at what some are calling a Republican Cold War happening. Plus, the new administration looking to, quote, recalibrate its relationship with Saudi Arabia. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly. Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. And our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. This week, former President Trump put out a blistering statement, and I think it's fair to call it a blistering statement, attacking his former ally and arguably the most powerful Republican in Washington, Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell. McConnell, who voted to acquit Trump in the impeachment trial, was still very critical of the former president, laying the blame of the January insurrection on Trump. So, Jonathan, how did we get to this point where the two men are really going after each other?
You have to remember that Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell, in terms of personality and experience, are total opposites. Trump is impulsive. McConnell is very, very calculating. Trump deeply cares how others feel about him and what they say about him. Mitch McConnell could care less. Mitch McConnell is a political professional. He has been in this game for many, many, many years. Donald Trump, to be kind, is a political dilettante. McConnell was willing to pocket the gains that Trump made in terms of appointing conservative judges to federal courts. He didn't like Trump very much. It's kind of well known up on the Hill that he loathed him. But as I said, he was willing to take advantage of the conservative gains that he made. I think that what happened for McConnell is that Trump's behavior, particularly in the runoff election in Georgia, basically cost the Republicans the majority in the Senate. And that meant that it cost McConnell his Senate majority leader's position. So he lost personally because of Trump's behavior. So what's happening now is that the Republican Party is deeply split between those who support Trump and want him to be a influential figure in the Republican Party going forward. I think the latest poll was 75% of Republicans polled wanted Trump to play a major role. And then there is McConnell, who represents the old guard Republicans, conservative Republicans who believe in strong national defense and fiscal responsibility, strong national security credentials. And these two forces now within the party are at war with one another. And in terms of a outlook of what's going to happen, we'll just have to wait until the midterm elections in 2022 to see who prevails.
It's really fascinating. And Ashraf, to Jonathan's point, and polling amongst Republicans show that Trump still has this massive hold over his party. Lindsey Graham, a key ally of Trump, a senator, he's stuck with Trump through it all. He's basically been saying that Trump is the future of the party, and McConnell would be wise to remember that. So how does McConnell navigate the party away from Trump? Can he?
That is the question. I think it is clear that that is McConnell's publicly stated goal at this point, is to wean the Republican Party away from Trump and Trumpism and sort of keep the votes, keep the people that he brought into the tent, because Trump brought in record numbers. It's almost a chicken and egg thing as to who was using who for the past 4 years. Was Trump using McConnell? Was McConnell using Trump? And there's definitely a perspective where McConnell got as much as he could out of Trumpism. You know, he got the tax cuts, he got the judges, he stacked the Supreme Court. And once Trump was no longer politically useful to him, then he becomes just this giant liability. And that's where we're at right now. So, yeah, it's fascinating. McConnell has turned on Trump. So Trump publicly trashes McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, who was Trump's transportation secretary for 4 years.
Yes, so, let's not forget that. And also, I mean, as you mentioned, McConnell may have gotten a lot from Trump, but by making a deal with Trump, by getting close to Trump, he may also have destroyed the Republican Party as he knows and wants it. And Republicans are obviously pouncing on Biden's agenda, whether we're talking about the COVID relief plan or an immigration bill that's coming down the pipeline. But Does it make it much harder for them to attack the Democrats, Jonathan, when the leaders of their party are going after each other?
I don't think so. I don't think anything will stop Republicans from attacking Democrats. McConnell has said that the way to unite the two conflicting wings of the Republican Party right now is for them to come together to oppose Biden's stimulus bill. So I don't think there's going to be any hesitation on the part of Republicans to go after Democrats.
Well, Democrats, meanwhile, are calling for a 9/11 style commission to investigate the January riots. And Democrats have been arguing that there cannot be unity unless there's accountability. Ashraf, what do you make of the flip side to that argument that there was an impeachment trial, it's over, and continuing to rehash what happened will only keep the country mired in this sort of toxic and divisive moment?
That is going to be the exact Republican argument going forward, and it's going to be persuasive in some camps. Like, as sort of fatigue as Trump kind of, I don't know if he's going to really fade, but fades a little bit. He's not in the White House. He's not tweeting. So, yes, as Trump fades a bit, you know, the Republicans are going to be able to just kind of roll their eyes and say, why are we still doing this? Suddenly, the Republicans become the party of unity and wanting to move on and find a better future together. And why are we relitigating this? So that's going to resonate with Republican voters and honestly with some extremely fatigued Democratic voters.
And Biden has said he wants to move on from Trump as well, but there is a large portion of the Democratic Party that does not. And sort of look at this cynically, they can also rile up the base by focusing on Trump. But let's shelve that conversation, move on to Texas, where the death toll is climbing in that state as millions continue to face the brutal cold without heat, without water. You have carbon monoxide poisoning shooting up as people desperate to stay warm are running their cars in their garage. They're turning on their gas stoves. It's an awful situation. There's a lot of blame being thrown around. Jonathan, I'm a little confused here. Texas is the energy capital of this country. How is it that millions there have no power?
This is a structural issue for Texas. Texas is the only state in the union that is not connected to the national power grid. And they did this in order to avoid any federal regulation. When the weather is good, and usually it is pretty good in Texas, it's a southern state. Most places in Texas were getting ready for spring vacation and bathing suit weather when this storm hit. But one of the downsides of not having any federal regulations or freeing themselves from federal regulations is that they did not winterize their equipment. So, for example, they have wind turbines in Texas, quite a few of them, and 23% of their energy is produced by wind power. In other states that use wind turbines, they put in antifreeze, just like we do in our cars, to winterize your car. They didn't do that. So the turbines froze up. But also, because of the extraordinary nature of this storm, I mean, this is kind of a very, very unique storm for a state like Texas. Everything is frozen up. So on one hand, you can blame the lack of regulation and the lack of winterizing, but this storm has been so cold and so extensive that all methods of producing power, gas-powered turbines, nuclear power, all of that has frozen up. So the blame game doesn't really work because there are so many reasons why the power is gone. If you have to find one place to blame or one thing to blame, it would be the storm itself.
Right. There's a lot to unpack in that answer, and I wish we had more time to sort of get into this. But, you know, when California had rolling blackouts because of massive fires there, Republicans attacked California, a blue state. Now you have Democrats attacking Texas, a red state, for their power outages. It's a lot of sort of both sides attacking each other. Ashraf, how is it that extreme weather events have become so political? And I guess the broader issue that Jonathan brought up, as we continue to have these extreme weather situations, scientists say caused by climate change, is the issue here that the country in general needs to work on infrastructure?
One of the issues that, as we've discovered, everything can become political. If we manage to politicize wearing a mask during a pandemic, then everything becomes political. So we've already had the back and forth over, as Jonathan said, one of the problems was with the wind turbines. So you had one side saying, oh, see, this proves that green energy is leading us off of a cliff. Meanwhile, the truth is that it was just failure to maintain, you know, to perform basic maintenance on the green energy equipment that led us here. As we've seen, we as a culture have managed to politicize science in a way that cannot be good for planning or good policy. And this is affecting medicine. This is affecting climate change, energy. It's not a particularly good way to go. And places like Texas, I could totally see how they've ended up in this situation. You know, I was a young kid in Texas. I was 8 years old living in Texas. And it would snow exactly once a year, usually in February, and it would last one day. You had one day to, like, have your snowball fights, and then it would melt. They're not equipped culturally or infrastructure-wise for any kind of a serious deep freeze. So I can only imagine what's going on there with no power, people running their cars, people getting sort of like space heaters that are starting fires. They're just not ready for it.
Shayna, if I could just add one thing. The fact that science has been politicized and that we see this coming out in not only the debates over wearing masks, as Ashraf says, the science or the questions that are being brought up about the Green Deal in relation to the storm in Texas. I think what this shows is how deeply the country is divided and why that means that Trump, I don't think, is going to fade that quickly. I mean, I know that this is the hope of Biden, and by not even mentioning his name during the town hall that he held, he calls him the other guy or the previous guy, right? I know that there's a lot of hope that he will fade as a result of his being taken off Twitter and Facebook.
He's able to really tap into the divide in the country, and we're seeing that divide, as you say, play out in so many different ways, including this extreme weather event. So we only have a couple of minutes left in the show. I want to focus on some global stories. The White House this week said President Biden plans on, quote, recalibrating the relationship with Saudi Arabia. He's going to be reaching out to the country's King Salman instead of its de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. It's a definite shift from Trump's relationship with the kingdom that we saw. But what's the reality here, Ashraf? I mean, the Crown Prince is the future of the country. Can Biden just ignore him?
No. The reality is that this is partially cosmetic. Not to sound too cynical about geopolitics, but it's significant that he's publicly seems to be sidelining him, saying, oh, we're not going to, you know, that there's not going to be a call between Biden and the Crown Prince. That's a big deal. Like, symbolically, the way these countries take this kind of, like, you know, I lived in Egypt for a long time. And, you know, when the president would call President Mubarak, that was a big deal. The newspapers, you know, that's a status thing. So being frozen out publicly, that does affect status, and that does matter to these guys a lot. But this is where the oil is. This is our main strategic partner, America's main strategic partner against Iran. You know, there's just too much at stake here. So there might be some recalibration of the extent of American involvement in Yemen. This has already happened to an extent. But the core strategic partnership between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, with all of its flaws and all of its horrors, and the United States of America is not going to change.
And in all reality and in honesty, when the U.S. has to work with allies, sometimes those allies are not exactly perfect, although Biden has said that the Saudis will not be getting a blank check from this administration when it comes to human rights abuses. So we're going to have to see how that plays out. Really quickly, last question to you, Jonathan. Another big story is the future of America's presence in Afghanistan. Trump promised to pull troops out. What are we hearing from the Biden administration on that front?
The troop pullout has been suspended, and they are reviewing the force posture in Afghanistan. It's not clear that the troops are going to be coming out. The military will review this and will hear what they have to say. But the peace talks that have been going on in Afghanistan in Qatar over Afghanistan are sort of frozen right now, and the Taliban basically say they are willing to keep on fighting. So this war, which has, I think, in September will have gone on for 20 years. So I think we're going to just see more fighting over there until there is some negotiated solution, which right now seems a bit far away.
All right. We'll have to watch to see what happens on that front. That's all for this week's show. Thanks to Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. This program is produced by Voice of America. I'm Shayna Stulen. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we examine the phenomenon of truth decay. Our guest, Jennifer Kavanaugh, a political scientist at the Washington office of the RAND Corporation. That's a research organization that develops solutions to public policy challenges to improve the safety, security, and prosperity of communities throughout the world. Jennifer Kavanaugh leads the Countering Truth Decay Initiative at RAND, which consists of a portfolio of projects exploring the diminishing reliance on facts and analysis in American public life. Jennifer is also the Director of Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program. Her research focuses on U.S. defense strategy, international conflict and military interventions, disinformation, and the relationship between U.S. political and media institutions. Truth decay, or the blurring of the line between fact and opinion, has been exacerbated by extreme political polarization, traditional and social media echo chambers that often confirm pre-existing beliefs, and the dissemination of disinformation and misleading or biased information. The coronavirus pandemic, which has forced people to stay indoors and surf the web, has also accelerated the spread of false information, even causing some to doubt the efficacy of vaccines. The January 6th violent attack on the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters, which resulted in at least 5 deaths, scores injured, and the destruction of federal property, is a consequence of truth decay, as those who engaged in this assault on the peaceful transfer of power, the hallmark of American democracy, were motivated by conspiracy theories and falsehoods. We'll ask Jennifer Kavanaugh to talk about the origins and main drivers of truth decay and how we can mitigate this deleterious trend, which, if left unchecked, could further undermine the social compact. And Jennifer Kavanaugh joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, let me ask you the very basic question first off. How do you define the term truth decay, and what evidence for it exists?
Well, we define truth decay as the diminishing role that facts, data, and analysis increasingly play in our political and civil discourse and in the policymaking process. And we would point to a number of different trends as being evidence of truth decay. One is increasing disagreement about facts and data. You can see this in a number of different domains. One would be the safety of vaccines. As we get more and more information that vaccines are safe, we still have an increasing number of people who believe that they're not. Another trend that is a marker of truth decay would be the blurring of the line between fact and opinion. You see that in public policy discourse. You read it in newspapers. You see it on television. The way in which fact and fiction and opinion are blurred in a way that's really hard to distinguish. And at the same time, we have so much more information now, and so much of that information is commentary and opinion and people's takes on issues, that it can really overwhelm the facts. And then the final trend would be declining trust in institutions that used to be looked to as sources of factual information. So be like the government and the media. And this declining trust means that people not only struggle to figure out what's true and what's not, but they don't even have an authoritative source to turn to get that information.
Jennifer, given the proliferation of falsehoods, outright lies, conspiracy theories that so many individuals and groups take as fact, some say we are in a post-truth or post-fact era. What's your perspective?
Well, we don't really share that view, because while we do see a declining reliance on facts and evidence and data in certain areas, certainly in the policy domain around issues of healthcare, around topics like immigration and crime rates. So here we're talking mainly about public issues, political discourse. So we definitely see it there, but we don't see it everywhere. So if you look at other things like sports, baseball or football, the drive for better and more data and sports analytics to make teams perform better. If you look at how businesses are operating, increasing, trying to get data, whether that's data on consumers or data on their own performance to improve their revenue and their profits. Or, you know, another area where RAND works is the military. And the military is making great strides in trying to accumulate data to inform their decision making and their strategies. So we see an increasing reliance on data and leveraging of data in certain areas, but not in this kind of public policy, political discourse domain. So to say that we're in a post-truth society would mean that that rejection of facts and evidence was everywhere, and we don't see that. So that's why we use the term truth decay to describe the phenomenon.
No, it just reminds me of former President Trump's senior counselor, Kellyanne Conway, who invented the term alternative facts, which in fact are really falsehoods. But as you say, that's not pervasive. And that's a good thing that in some domains, data and facts are truly critical and are not being doubted. So you talked about the trends that characterize truth decay. What about the so-called drivers of truth decay? How would you describe those?
Well, we focus on a number of different causes or drivers of the phenomena. Certainly one major one is changes in information technology, changes in the way that we consume and share information. And here I'm talking about the rise of the internet, the ubiquity now of social media platforms, the volume and speed at which information travels and is shared, the democratization of the information environment, which allows everybody to have a voice and a platform. All these things have both provided access, but also provided opportunity to amplify the spread of disinformation and for actors with nefarious intentions to make use of those platforms to spread falsehoods. But information technology, social media, is certainly not the only factor here. Other things we point to are just simply the way humans process information. There are characteristics of our information processing, like all the cognitive biases and heuristics that affect what we think and how we make decisions, like motivated reasoning. We like to be right. We seek out information that proves we're right. So this plays a big role in kind of confirmation of our false beliefs, and those beliefs then become entrenched. We also look at polarization, the role that not just political polarization, but social and economic and demographic polarization play in creating very insulated, homogenous groups of people in which alternative narratives can thrive. And there's a demand for this kind of unique narrative for each community. And those narratives can diverge substantially. And if there's no crosstalk, we never get a sharing of ideas, and that plays a role in the phenomenon. And then finally, we talk about the role of individual susceptibility and the role that education plays in that. The challenge here is that technology changes quickly and institutions like school change slowly. As a result, there's a gap between the skills that students get in school and then what they need to do when they enter the information environment. Adults face the same challenge. They didn't receive these skills in school either. And so this gap between what people need to know to effectively manage and navigate the information environment in such polarized times and the skills they have don't match up. That creates this susceptibility, which just contributes then even more to the phenomena overall.
And Jennifer, it feels like all of this is happening more intensely now for the reasons you outlined: the ubiquity of the internet, information technology changes so quickly, the fact that schools can't keep up, polarization. And yet there must be historical precedents in our history. And I was wondering how you would characterize the magnitude of the problem we're experiencing today with respect to truth decay compared to previous historical periods.
That's a great question. I mean, we definitely have seen periods in the past that look similar in U.S. history. So some of the things that we point to in our research, like the 1880s to 1890s, where you have the rise of mass-produced newspapers and the phenomenon known as yellow journalism. Yellow journalism was characterized by exaggerated and outlandish stories that were put in newspapers to sell newspapers. That sounds familiar in some ways to today. We also look at the 1920s, 1930s. Here you have the rise of radio. Again, radio platforms were leveraged by powerful individuals to spread their opinions, much in the same way that cable news is used today. And then we look at the 60s and early 70s. Again, a period characterized by some of the same social dynamics as we have now, a lot of social unrest and division, polarization, and again, changes in information with the rise of television. So in all of these eras, we have this change in the information technology, which seems to open the door for a proliferation of false and misleading information as we grapple with this new technology. So there are a lot of similarities. And the key difference that we know between today and these previous periods is this increasing disagreement about objective facts and data. Certainly, there's been disagreement about facts and data in the past. So we're not pointing to the disagreement as being new. What we're pointing to as being new as this divergence between the direction of people's attitudes and the trajectory of data. So as we get more and more data about things like the safety of vaccines, which I mentioned before, or the safety of GMOs, we get more and more people believing that they are not safe. So that divergence does seem to be unique to this period and something that does make this period uniquely dangerous. And as you mentioned, social media could play a role in that, the internet, our ability to feel like experts because we have Google and other types of search engines at our fingertips. That could be playing a role in why we see this unique characteristic.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jennifer Kavanaugh. She's director of the Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program at the RAND Corporation, where she leads the Countering Truth Decay Initiative. She joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And here's a shout out to a loyal and devoted listener, Isaiah Udo Uyo from Akwa Ibom State in Nigeria. Thanks so much for your kind email. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Jennifer Kavanaugh, and we're discussing this phenomenon of truth decay. So Jennifer, speaking of our mostly foreign audience, how does America compare to other democracies around the world regarding truth decay? I mean, we normally associate propaganda, false narratives with authoritarian and totalitarian regimes, you know, regimes that normally, as a matter of course, trample on freedom of the press. But when our own freedom of speech, you know, allows for hate speech and disinformation, it seems like it's more of an insidious and dangerous trend to the integrity of democracy and the flow of truth and facts. And I was wondering to what extent we're seeing this phenomenon in other countries and other democracies in particular.
I think that we do see some evidence of this phenomenon in other democracies. I think we can especially point to some examples in Europe, things like Brexit. Certainly there are examples in countries like France. We've done a little bit of work looking into whether or not we see the prevalence of the trends that characterize truth decay to the same extent, specifically in the European context more generally. And, you know, that work is still ongoing. We're definitely finding some evidence, but there are definitely differences. Differences because of America's unique political character, the political system, the individualism that Americans hold so important. Freedom of speech as being this paramount ideal that's protected by the First Amendment. So there are certainly differences. So I think, you know, we do see this trend at a global level. I think we see evidence of it in other areas as well. But I do think that it has some unique characteristics in the United States and probably in other countries as well because of the character of the people, the character of the political systems, the character of the social dynamics, things like that.
Jennifer Kavanaugh, what about the role of politicians here in the United States, whether members of Congress or the executive branch? Do you see a trend among politicians that are feeding and are somehow disseminating disinformation?
Well, we do identify political actors as one of what we call agents of truth decay. So you can imagine that truth decay is not a natural phenomenon like a hurricane. Certainly there's human intent behind it. There may be aspects of truth decay that take on a life of their own or seem to be self-generating, but there are agents that play a role in exacerbating it and spreading it. And political actors are one category of people that we identify as playing this agent role. Certainly not all political actors are contributing to the problem, but we do identify ways in which political actors, not just representatives, are members of the government, but also political lobbying organizations that contribute to the problem. And they can do it not only by spreading falsehoods, but even just by cherry picking facts to make their point, or sticking to a partisan line over the factual evidence, or exhibiting a closed-mindedness to looking at evidence on the other side of an argument. So definitely political actors play a role. Other actors that we identify as playing an agent role, certainly foreign influence is one. There's been a lot of discussion about the role that Russia plays, China, Iran. Media can play a role. Again, not all aspects of the media, but certainly there are media actors that have partisan or economic motives that lead them to spread false or misleading information. And then we also point to academia and research. And again, in this area, it's not all researchers, not everyone who's working in academia, but certainly there are incentives, whether it's to publish articles or to make a name for yourself, to manipulate data or be misleading in the way you present data that can contribute to the problem. So there's, you know, many different actors that are playing a role in feeding this phenomenon.
Well, it seems to me that last agent, academia, that's extremely dangerous and insidious, because that's the very institution you rely on for objective information or data.
Yes, and I don't want to give the impression that even a majority of researchers are acting with that kind of intention, but I do think that you have to understand the role it can play. I mean, just look at the boost that the anti-vax movement got from the discredited Andrew Wakefield study about vaccines contributing to autism. That study has been disproven and retracted, and yet people still cite that study as the reason why they don't believe in the safety of vaccines. So one study like that can have a really far-reaching impact.
Well, thank you for putting that in context. Nonetheless, we all have to be critical thinkers when we consume research or any other material. And I have a question to follow up on the political actors, Jennifer, and that is, do you think that decay is worse on the right of the political spectrum?
Well, our research hasn't specifically tried to disentangle the differences across political lines. I mean, I would say that the decay happening on either side does appear different. And certainly if you're talking specifically on topics like election integrity, which we just experienced over the past 3 or 4 months, and in the context of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, in that space, most of the disinformation was on the right. But there are certainly issues, vaccines being a good case, where disinformation and decay seems to span the political spectrum. So I think it really depends on the context and the issues that you're discussing.
Jennifer, speaking of the horrific attack on the Capitol on January 6th, let's talk about the danger of conspiracy theories. Where do these crazy theories originate, such as QAnon and some of the beliefs that anti-government militias have been propagating? And don't forget, speaking of our history here in the United States, we have what we call survivalist cults also, and they're very anti-government. Where do these originate? How can they be fought? And, you know, how do they get so embedded, even when these theories are debunked over and over again, and people seem to continue to believe in them?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons why we see conspiracies pop up. I mean, one of the reasons that people cling to conspiracies is because it helps them to make sense of the world. There's certainly a lot of uncertainty in the world. We as human beings in general are not comfortable with uncertainty. And so conspiracy theories can help to tell a story that ties things together, that helps things to make sense, that gives individuals a set of principles or a story to live by. The reason why these often become so entrenched, I think, is twofold. One is that when you are part of a conspiracy, you often become part of a tribe of other people who believe in the same thing. And that sense of belonging can keep you involved, even if the principles themselves are disproven. In addition, I think that believing things like this can often be part of someone's identity. So when you're trying to convince someone that this conspiracy isn't true, you're also challenging what they see as their identity. And that's why they can be so difficult to dislodge. I think that during this pandemic, we've seen a real proliferation of these conspiracies because there is so much uncertainty and so much dislocation, and people are grasping at anything that can help to give them answers. So that compounds the challenge that we would face normally. In terms of, you know, how you break the hold of these conspiracies, it's very difficult. There's, you know, a number of different theories of how you might approach this. Certainly for some, seeing evidence that their conspiracy, that their story isn't true, can help to open the door to other types of information. But it's really important to think about who's providing that other type of information. It's usually not an outsider. it's usually someone that that person already trusts, whether it's a family member or someone from the religious community. So it's a tricky balance of providing the more realistic view while also identifying the right messenger so that person is open to the information in the first place.
No question about it. You know, we're seeing even, for example, within the Republican Party, many in the Republican Party have denounced QAnon and other conspiracy theories, and yet there seems to be a faction that still clings to that. So there are diehards in many groups that will probably not let go. But let's go back to social media, because as you said, in today's world, compared to other historical periods where we have seen truth decay, it's just exacerbated by social media, what we call, you know, citizen journalists, people who just write things on Facebook or whatever platform. There are no editors. There's no way to verify. And many people have decided, you know, that that doesn't really matter. To what extent do you think, in addition to social media, the rise of cable networks, which, unlike broadcast media, seem to contribute to the blurring of fact and opinion? These cable networks, both on the right and on the left, but particularly on the right, we're seeing are motivated by profit over fairness and objectivity. I don't know why they are not governed by what is called the fairness doctrine, which used to, and I believe still governs, broadcast networks, whereby our Federal Communications Commission requires that holders of broadcast licenses present controversial issues of public importance in a manner that is honest, equitable, and balanced.
So the fairness doctrine, you're right in describing it. It is no longer enforced, but you are right that when it was enforced, it only applied to network television. There's mixed evidence on whether the fairness doctrine actually achieved its objectives. On the one hand, certainly it did require that broadcasters provide perspectives on both sides of an issue. But on the other hand, to kind of avoid getting in trouble, there's some evidence that broadcasters just avoided talking about public issues altogether. And so that isn't necessarily a public good in the sense that people need broadcasters to be providing them with that information. In terms of the role that cable news plays, you know, I do think that cable news plays a role in this blurring of the line between fact and opinion. Certainly, cable news, because of their business model, is geared towards providing what I would call outrage journalism, things, commentary, opinions that are intended to stir up emotion, to cause you to have an emotional, typically angry or scared or anxiety-filled response that will make you keep watching. And so that type of communication and broadcasting is not the same kind of fact-based investigative journalism that provides kind of that basis of factual evidence for people to make decisions. I think it's important to keep in mind that cable audiences themselves, even for, you know, the primetime shows, are pretty small overall, much smaller than broadcast networks, much smaller than newspaper subscriptions, even after newspaper subscriptions have fallen. So I think that it's important to keep in mind that the actual number of people watching this is small, but that those watchers tend to be very devoted to those shows and also then to be kind of some of the most prolific spreaders of false information in online circles. So when we think about the chain of information, I think cable news plays an important role in shaping the narrative that then spreads outward from there.
You mentioned newspapers. Do you think that the demise of like local newspapers and even disdain we are seeing toward major standard bearers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, even the Wall Street Journal and others, do you think that contributes to truth decay?
Well, I think that anything that removes objective and fact-based sources of information from the information environment is not a good thing. Local news has value because it does tend to be that type of information, and it does tend to provide individuals with very detailed and specific fact-based information that allows them to make decisions about their lives because it's reporting on local conditions. For some people, they don't have, you know, the New York Times. It may not even be sold at local convenience stores. So that local paper serves as a lifeline of information. So losing that leaves them in what some people call like a news desert. And if they don't get that information, then they have no source of evidence and facts on which to base their decisions.
Picking up on what you said, people are getting more and more information from social media platforms where there are no editors, there's no real oversight, even though Facebook and Twitter are trying to flag hate speech or outright lies. To what extent do you blame these social media platforms for truth decay or as a major factor?
Social media certainly plays a role in this problem. I think that oftentimes that role is overstated. It's certainly not only a social media problem. We've talked about the role that cable news plays. We see blurring of the line between fact and opinion, even in major newspapers. So this is not a phenomenon that's isolated and restricted to social media. I think that the major role that social media plays is in amplifying the spread of disinformation and making it easier for people to do that. Because it used to be, if you wanted to spread false information, you had to tell people. So your ability to spread it was limited to the number of people you could tell. Now, with a push of a button, you can spread false information to millions of people. They can spread that to millions of people. So from my perspective, it really does play this role of a conduit. I think it's important, though, to recognize that social media is not all bad. A democratized information environment certainly removes some of the filters and the checks that used to be in place to remove some of the low-quality information. But in the old information system, information was dominated in the hands of just a few people. It was controlled by mostly white men. So in the current environment, minorities, women, people who didn't have a voice in the past now have a platform. And so one thing that we found in our research was that women and minority populations were much more likely to express that they felt that the media environment now was more reliable than in the past. And part of that may be because they see themselves, they feel represented. And so it's important to balance when we think about the role social media plays in truth decay, the negative things that we see, such as the amplification of false information, with the positive things, which is a greater diversification of access to this platform.
And Jennifer, as we close, I'd like you to suggest any recommendations RAND Corporation has that you're formulating in the process of trying to counter this trend of truth decay. What are your major recommendations for individuals, other groups, civil society, politicians, and our schools? You know, what can be done to both counter and prevent truth decay?
Truth decay is a multifaceted problem, and it's going to require a multifaceted solution. So I think that we can think about solutions from the supply side and the demand side. On the demand side, on the side of the consumer, I think that one of the key things that we focus on is education, whether that's media literacy, civic education. These things can provide individuals with the tools they need to sift through different types of information, to spend the time to analyze, identify bias, synthesize different perspectives, understand the role that the media plays in a democracy. It would also include things like science literacy, understanding of statistics, so that people can be informed and effectively navigate the information environment. And it doesn't have to be limited to children. We think about these education initiatives as being centered in schools, but certainly adults need this type of education as well. So on the demand side, I think that's where I would focus. On the supply side, I think there are things that media providers and broadcasters can do to help consumers. Making sure that the line between fact and opinion is clear is one. Even in major newspapers and broadcast television, we often see this blending of commentary and fact. And I think that anything that we can do to make it easier for consumers, labeling information, making sure that those two are separate, can be helpful so that information consumers then know when they're reading fact and when they're reading opinion. And this is not to say that opinion is bad, just that it's different. And we want to make sure that people understand the type of information they're getting. And then the final thing I think I would focus on, at least in the media space, would be thinking about how we want to manage or govern the online space. We talked about the role that different types of disruptive technologies have played over time in phenomena like truth decay. And those have gradually ebbed because we developed systems to manage the new information environment. So here I'm not talking about regulation, but I am talking about rules of the road and ways that we are able to govern the online space to make it work for us so that we can leverage the advantages without all the risks. The final thing I'll say is that I think polarization plays a big role, and we can't have a solution to this problem without tackling that as well. That's a harder problem to tackle. We do see from research that having bridging conversations, bringing different groups together to have these types of dialogues can be really valuable in helping to bridge those divides. Rebuilding trust in government, things like building government transparency, increasing diversity so that people see themselves in government, and really, again, going back to education, making sure that people have an understanding of what it means to live in a democracy, both the government's responsibilities and their responsibilities, can help to rebuild and restore trust in that domain that may have some benefits in terms of bridging those divides.
Jennifer Kavanaugh is a political scientist at the RAND Corporation. She leads the organization's Countering Truth Decay initiative. Jennifer, thank you so much for your keen insights on this very fascinating and critical topic.
Thanks for the discussion today.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz.